The comics ain't just the funnies.
And that matched up with my notions of what comics could do that was way outside the loop of the stoned-out comics and taboo-busting underground comic stuff that surrounded me and that I'd been working on prior to that.
That's comics master Art Spiegelman, and this is Writer's Voice. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Art Spiegelman came out with Mouse in 1986, the book exploded notions about the limited role of comics as art and literature. Winning a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992, the only comic book ever to do so, Mouse is a memoir in graphic form of Spiegelman's father's experiences in Auschwitz and the impact that had on the artist's own childhood growing up in New York City. His mother was also a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps. In 1968, she committed suicide soon after Spiegelman himself was released from a mental hospital after suffering a nervous breakdown. Mouse was prefigured in an earlier work, Prisoner on the Hell Planet, and in 1978, Spiegelman included that and other works in a collection of his underground comics called Breakdowns. Innovative and drawn in a variety of styles in large format, Breakdowns sank like a stone. But now Spiegelman has reissued it with a new 20-page introduction that's worth the price of the book alone. Our interview was recorded last week, and on my way into the studio in the basement of the campus center here at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, I noticed a slender young guy manning the table of the UMass Comic Arts Society in the main concourse. I stopped in to chat for a few minutes. He told me his name, Curtis Sarkin, and that he draws comic strips for the campus newspaper, The Daily Collegian, and is an English major. On impulse, I asked Curtis if he would like to join me in interviewing Art Spiegelman. Well, as you can imagine, his eyes lit up, and a few hours later, Curtis sat down with me in front of the microphones as Art Spiegelman joined us on the phone from his book tour. Well, Art Spiegelman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me, Francesca.
Now, you have reissued this book, Breakdowns, with an extensive introduction. It's a memoir told in the form of a graphic novel. What's the relationship between Breakdowns and your earlier Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Mouse?
Well, it was the... Should I correct several phrases that made me...
Oh, please do.
Bristle?
Yes.
I don't know what it is, but I'm not sure that it's a graphic novel. I think of it as comics, maybe comics with an X. And there's something else, but I forget now. Early on in your... Oh, yes, a reissue. Really what it is it's a rebirth.
Say more about that.
Well, there's a book I made in 1978, or end of 77. There was a gathering of my rather strange works from 72 to 77. In a very large deluxe format at a time where that didn't exist, gathering work that was partially autobiographical and partially, I never know the word, formal, experimental. There wasn't a phrase like deconstructionist, but maybe it was deconstruct. I don't know what to call it, but experimental comics. And it's that work that ultimately was what gave birth to the Long Mouse in a couple of ways. One, the first three-page version of Mouse that had been done for an underground comic was the earliest piece collected in this book, and an important one for me in terms of finding my own way as a maker of stuff, and also because the book itself was so formidably out of step with anything cultural around it that it disappeared. It just was published into a sea of silence, and I realized if I want to keep making comics, I better tell a story that people can understand quickly and in one reading, even if they could go back and reread it, as opposed to the comics that were in that original Breakdowns book that were, you had to read them only so that you could go back and reread them, many of those pieces. That was the only way to find what was actually there. But I don't think of them as, I mean, they were in a way the opposite of graphic novels, even though I know I'm considered one of the daddies of the graphic novel these days. I'm still asking for a blood test because although I really admire and love a lot of what's going on around me, it's amazing. It's by its nature, it tends to the very long. And sometimes that works really well. Like Mouse was a long work, but it was also a very compressed work. It's 300 pages that I suppose if I'd done it with a different set of rhythms could have been an 800 or 900 or more page book.
Compressed in what way?
Well, in terms of how much... How charged with information is it? How, you know, I I think back in the 70s, I had to write something about my work, and I was just using the metaphor of concentrated orange juice that you use your brain as the water for. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, which is why I never even thought the book would come back into the world, even though all of those pieces, I'm very, not all, but many of the pieces in that relatively short book are the cornerstones of what I understand. So it's not exactly like, oh, he's publishing his old work, he's getting it out of the bottom drawer, and he's just shoving it back in the world. It's not like I think of it as juvenilia. I just think of it as the core of what I think about, even when I was making Mouse. And it tends toward a high degree of concentrated visual information and bursts of language that are then to be unpacked later. Is this making any sense?
It is making some sense, as you're saying it, and I definitely want to explore a little bit more about that. But first, actually, I would like to bring in and introduce to you my guest co-host today here, Curtis Sarkin, who is a student here at UMass. He's also a comic strip artist, and he's a member of the Amherst Comic Art Society. Curtis?
I'm part of the UMass Amherst Comic Art Society.
Hi, Curtis. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And I know he's got some questions, too, but I kind of want to go back to this unpacking, and maybe if I could for a minute connect it up again with Mouse. I mean, Mouse is such an amazing classic, and in fact, Curtis was telling me that he has as assigned reading in two of his classes. Is that right, Curtis?
Yeah, comparative literature as well as English, one of which wasn't even focusing on comics, just society and literature.
And I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Well, you know, when it first started happening, I was worried because, you know, when I was in, I think, junior high school, I had to read Silas Marner, and it almost kept me from ever reading again anything. So at first I was like really concerned that, oh, geez, it's going to become like medicine. You know, you've got to read it and write papers on it and analyze it. But then I tend to fret a lot and worry. And on the other hand, I got to say that the way it's played out hasn't been that at all. It's been just probably what keeps the book in print, since most books have about the same shelf life as yogurt. It keeps this thing being attended to and read, and it does show up in the oddest classes. Like, there's somebody who told me once that it was in an Eskimo literature class, and like, he couldn't explain why, but obviously the teacher liked the book. And then more than once I've been told it's been used in psych classes to study the dysfunctional family, which I consider a bad honor.
And that's a compliment there. Well, talking about dysfunctional families, actually, you open Breakdowns, actually the introduction to Breakdowns, which is a lengthy one.
Well, that's the thing, Francesca, when you said it was a reissue, I was going, no, it's a rebirth, because basically it's a new book that has this other book at its heart. Like, what started out as an introduction is half as long as the book itself.
That's right, and it's a very, very powerful. I mean, I just, I had to stop and process it as I was going through it, and I think that gets back to your idea of the compression.
You got it, that's right.
Yeah, and in it, you begin with talking about your mother. Your parents were Holocaust survivors. You told their story in Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. And here you begin, you have a drawing of you dressed in the striped pajamas of a concentration camp inmate yourself. And you say, in 1968, my mother killed herself and she left no note. First of all, why do you open with this? And then tell us, why are you in striped pajamas?
Well, okay, to answer that, I have to explain that that panel acts like what Linda Barry just wrote me an email about the book and described as a wormhole. You know, mm-hmm. It's like there are things in this strip at the beginning called Portrait of the Artist as a Young exclamation point, Arabat, asterisk exclamation point, or blankety blank, as they say in comics. And the introduction are all memories based on me looking back on a work I did 30 years ago, right? So in that particular sequence that's called Hell Planet, it refers to the strip Prisoner on the Hell Planet that was in that 1978 book. And that line you're just reading as a thought balloon is pretty much the same as the first panel of the 1978 strip. In 1968, my mother killed herself and she left no note. And there I am, drawn in a very different style, in a German expressionist woodcut style, maybe. Also dressed in complete concentration camp regalia. And as I say, the strip was called Prisoner on the Hell Planet. And that strip was probably the one that really made me understand the kind of comics I wanted to make rather than my version of How to Draw Keep on Trucking or Pervert Pirates or other Zap Comics all-star kind of things that I was basically imitating and striving toward in the years prior to 71, 72. And that strip is highly emotionally charged, and it deals with the ways in which I feel imprisoned by my mother's death. And ultimately, that strip was printed, although way, way, way too small, as a four-page thing within the Mao's books.
Way too small?
Oh, it's way too small. You know, comics are words and pictures, and actually, it's a simple question that has an interesting answer, which is, comics are, more than most things, site-specific.
Site-specific?
Yeah. You know, like, it's not the same to take a comic book and print it, like, 10 inches by 14 inches or 5 inches by 7 inches. It's unlike most of the writers, I suppose, that are on your show. They can print their book in any typeface that they choose, on any format that they choose. And comics really are meant to, they have some kind of ideal ratio for what they should be when they're printed. And the Breakdowns work is all quite a large format book. It's 11 by 14. Mao's is, I don't know what, like 6 by 9 at the most or something like that. It's a much more small and intimate scale.
Yeah.
And that intimacy was an aspect of what I wanted to make happen in Mao's. So you would climb into the story and stay there as if you were reading prose, but with images that are very articulated, but are still, it's a picture book, but where the narrative element of let's flip pages and read is one of the concerns, and the intimacy is one of the concerns. So I drew all the pictures in Mao's the same size as the book that you're reading.
So you're actually thinking about the quality of the attention of the viewer, of the reader.
Yeah, when the pictures are big, your eye skitters around the page differently, and you're asked to take the measure of the work in a different way, quite literally. I think it's one of the reasons why there is such a thing as a graphic novel society on campus, and why comics seem to be doing well while the rest of America turns to sludge, as things that one can find in bookstores, because almost by definition, comics take advantage of their bookness.
What you were saying about the size and just being able to see a big picture of it, it seems almost to me similar to like a CD album cover compared to a original record cover, the way you just look at that picture and it's so big and in your face, it's a lot
right.
more powerful.
Graphic designers would not make the Sgt. Pepper cover for
exactly.
The CD release. It never would have happened.
Huh.
So that kind of visual aspect of comics, which is at least half the game, one does different things for different sites, for different occasions. And so the Breakdowns book had to be large, and that's what, in fact, why it got born. It's not like somebody's saying, oh, we all want Spiegelman's work that he did from 1972 to 1977. It certainly wasn't the case. In the first edition of Breakdowns, there was like 4,000 copies that took quite a few years to disappear, but it was because I needed to see the work that way. It had been printed first too small in Underground Comics, and then in the Mao's books, way too small. It's just I didn't know how else to get through the narrative need to talk about my mother's suicide without skipping outside that mouse-cat metaphor that I'd been working with and enter this into the deposition, if that's what it is.
You know, it reminds me of a section of this book, and I'm speaking with Art Spiegelman about his rebirth of Breakdowns. It's the 1978 comics that he came out with, now has a long introduction, and I believe this is part of the introduction as well. And this is a little section called Form and Content.
Right near the end of the 20-page so-called introduction.
Yeah, exactly. And so here we're talking about form and content and their interrelationship with each other. Could you describe a little bit about what you are saying here? And do you have the book there with you?
I just grabbed it, yeah.
Great. So, you know, it's a little awkward because this is radio and I can't show our listeners, but there is there's basically the reprise of an earlier section in this part of the book, and they show a bully who's coming after the young Art Spiegelman, and also one who the same bully who has gone after his mother, spit upon his mother. So could you talk a little bit about this kind of connection between, well, what's the form and what's the content? Are the words...
Well, you know, these are Siamese twins. These are joined at the hip things that only language really separates, but different things tend to happen, which is, in that first section, one's getting an anecdote about little Art Spiegelman in 1954 when he's 6 years old. And again, very condensed, very compressed. Life in the playground with a mommy on the park and the kid getting knocked over, the kid Spiegelman getting knocked over by a bigger kid who steals his bolo paddle ball toy. And when the mother on the bench reprimands him, he throws the paddle ball toy at the mother who the young Art Spiegelman has gone to for shelter. And then the bully comes over, spits at the mother, and then walks away and kind of trying to maintain his calm, little Art Spiegelman says, "He was a bad boy, right, Mommy?" "Yes." So this was my fugitive refugee mother at a moment where I finally, at the age of six, discovered my parents can't protect me. Mm-hmm. I have to get my shelter elsewhere. And the title for that sequence is The Insult That Made a Man Out of Mac, with a Charles Atlas bodybuilding ad behind it, which was where I looked to for counsel when my parents didn't work out. I'd go to my comic books. And so that's a sequence that was, again, inspired by looking at the Hell Planet part of the Breakdowns book. And that leads to a section toward the end, at the end of the Portrait of the Artist stuff, as you say, called Form and Content, in which it's replayed in a whole different way. It's replayed with the colors shifting and colors shifting away from their outlines and forcing you to take another look at these pictures. And it guides you toward the aspects of Breakdowns that were not so involved in, just as I said when we were talking earlier, well, they just want a story. Let's give them a story they can read and not have to reread and worry about to get at least the lay of the land. It was when I got very interested in the formal aspects of what comics could be. And so the language in that section is a quotation from I think relatively obscure Russian formalist aesthetician named Viktor Shklovsky, and the quotation basically talks about the purpose of art. The purpose of art is to impart the sensation of things as they are perceived, not as they are known. Art exists that one may recover the sensation of life. It exists to make one feel things, to make the stone stony. The technique of art is to make objects unfamiliar, to make forms difficult, to increase the difficulty and length of perception, because the process of perception is an aesthetic end in itself, and it must be prolonged. Art is a way of experiencing the artfulness of an object. The object is not important. And that matched up with my notions of what comics could do that was way outside the loop of the stoned-out comics and taboo-busting underground comic stuff that surrounded me and that I'd been working on prior to that. And it was very, very far away from finding an audience that could follow along with me. It's one of the reasons I'm happily surprised to see the book even coming out again. And that section that I was just quoting is hard to, like, give you the full meaning of without having you look at the pictures along with me, but most of the pictures are, oh, God, what can I say? They're whacked versions of the first version that you saw, with some things upside down, inside out, colors not following the outlines, and yet right in the middle of it, there's that boy spitting again where you see him quite clearly. That content is unobstructed.
Exactly. There's that one panel, which is just like the one before. I mean, you get the full force and sense, the emotional sense of what's going on. I guess you recover the sensation of that life as it was lived.
That's the point. And also to make you stay with it. Like, you know, it's very different from the comics that I love and did love and that people associated with comics until they got rechristened graphic novels, which is the disposable thing. You read it once in a newspaper, then you wrap fish in it. You read a comic book, curl it up, put it in your back pocket, and don't keep track of what happened to it later. That's how most comics were consumed, and that's how most comics were made for that kind of consuming. That's real different than making something where you've got the same freedom and responsibilities that somebody making a painting or writing a novel might have. I'm sorry, Curtis, I interrupted you.
That's all right. Now, why is it that it seems each little story in this book is an entirely different style from the first one? Is there a specific reason you decided to not go with a certain style throughout?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's several reasons. One is that I have about 500 people living inside my brain, just like everybody else, but only about three of them can draw. Part of it also is just that I never kind of moved toward wanting to have one kind of trademark style, you know, that's something that one is sort of taught to do as a commercial artist. Like, it's your brand, the same way that General Electric is a brand. It's great for illustrators because they can get a gig from an art director who says, "Do that again." But for me, the form and content thing that Francesco was talking about is basic to the way I understand stuff, which is the way something looks on its surface is just part of the content. Like that style that Maus was drawn in was invented for the purpose. It wasn't a way I was drawing prior to that.
Are you still developing new styles then?
Well, kind of a reflecting and remixing other styles as best I can with my relatively limited natural born talent, so that each memory in that first section that you've plucked out a couple of just now, there's different ways of they look different from each other in a way. They have the same color palette and all the panels are the same size. But if you go from one of those little sequences to another, you'll see that some of them are drawn with a brush, some with a pen, some more exaggerated cartooning, some far less exaggerated cartoon styles. And I can't necessarily verbalize why each of those styles is used for each sequence, but it felt right in terms of giving that particular memory. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of the aspects of comics grammar is the surface look of something, so that some of it echoes underground comic styles around me, much more rubbery in its drawing, like I'm looking at a sequence that is done at the time that I was drawing that Prisoner on the Hell Planet thing. Some of it looks more like Mad Comics styles with more jam-packed background. Some of it is done in some kind of wacky, circa 1960, offbeat, less is more, post-Bauhaus cartoon style. Some of it looks like it's in that Tintin clear line style. And all of those are ways of giving the texture of that specific memory.
When you're reading someone else's graphic novel, what are kind of your turn-offs? Like, have you ever picked up something and decided right away not to read it based on
the
art style?
At this point, like I start sniffing around something, and within about an eighth of a second, I know if I want to sniff further or not. And it's not a matter of like, oh, this guy can't draw or this girl can't draw. It's more like, is somebody dealing with the architecture and form of comics in some level?
What do you mean by that?
Well, that's basically something that understands that their panels butted together on a page, that understands how one's eye decodes the information it's looking at, so that if panels get kind of too clotted and too much information that isn't articulated right, it's very hard to like climb in. So there's a certain level of craft, I suppose, I'm looking for on at least that level. So those are all things that kind of get me toward or away for something. And if anything looks too much like a superhero comic, I just sort of reach for my gun.
Now, you know, you were almost were sui generis. What were...
I was always hoping for a sui generis section in a bookstore and had to settle for graphic novels instead.
Who were the greatest influences on you, and were they, in fact, within the form of comics itself, or were they outside that field entirely?
Oh, some of both, of course. You know, and one thing that's always hard with influences is, like, you have to start, if you're really going to be honest, you have to start citing, like, man, that Rice Krispie package really changed my life, you know, because you don't even know how everything you're exposed to is actually getting tangled in your neurons. But there's certain people I can kind of cite as really important to be within comics. Very early on, Mad changed my life. Harvey Kurtzman's early Mad was probably the primary formative influence in comics for me. But then discovering in my even preteen and teen years Crazy Cat and old books and Little Nemo and In Slumberland by Winsor McCay and Carl Barks' Donald Duck and Little Orphan Annie, all of those, I mean, that's really formative for me. I just loved comics. In fact, I was very suspicious of any visual media that wasn't comics. I was kind of a slob snob and stayed definitely on my low end of the high-low hyphen art, and basically became obsessed with comics even. So I would find myself in newspaper libraries in the days of yore before they were put on microfilm. One could go and find old bound volumes, and I'd spend hours and hours like just discovering old comic strips. On the other side of the art equation, it came later. And actually, there's an anecdote within that introduction about being exposed to Picasso by a non-narrative filmmaker mentor and friend, Ken Jacobs, who taught me how to look at paintings without being suspicious of them, without figuring it was just a fraud being perpetrated on me by some racketeer.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Art Spiegelman about his reissue, or as he calls it, rebirth of Breakdowns, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Blankety Blank. And it comes with a terrific new introduction and epilogue. And I'm also joined here by UMass English major and comic strip artist Curtis Sarkin. Art Spiegelman, we were just talking about how you were able to start appreciating high art, and you have a wonderful thing on the back cover of Breakdowns of a Picasso takeoff.
Basically, what it is it's two portraits that are like those Dora Maar's Picasso faces, one made much more simply in his I'm going to rip off Matisse and make it better mode, and the other one much more densely and geometrically built. And that character is a character from the longest piece in Breakdowns. When we talk about compression as opposed to graphic novels, it was an 8-page story. It took me about 6 or 7 months to do, and it was specifically about the high-low stuff. So one character is Ace Hole Midget Detective, who's a kind of refugee from a noir novel, but about 3 feet high, and speaks in hard-boiled prose with thought balloons that ends with "I snarled" or "I spat at him" or whatever. And the femme fatale in this particular noir story is a Dora Maar-like character named Greta, representing the high end of the art equation, I suppose. And then there's another character in that strip, which is Mr. Potato Head, who's sort of a Sidney Greenstreet-like creature who has, like the child toy, the possibility of having both eyes on the side of one side of the head, just like Dora Maar's portraits by Picasso do. I loved it when I was a kid, rearranging those little pieces of plastic on potatoes.
Art Spiegelman, moving from influences on you, what about the influence of your work, in this case specifically Breakdowns, on the wider world of the comics?
Well, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I'd rather have Curtis, like, as with a professorial voice, say for me.
Okay, hey Curtis, what do you see as the impact of Art Spiegelman on you and folks like you who are coming up in this?
I just kind of see it as comics don't necessarily have to be a joke, and it can be basically anything. It's just a really diverse art form, and especially Mouse, just for me growing up with like a newspaper comics, I really saw that you can really successfully make a comic about any subject.
I would say in my own behalf, then, that part of it is the works that were in Breakdowns weren't necessarily seen in that book, but were seen in underground comics and things reprinted later. And I know, for example, I brought up Scott McCloud before. He credits his understanding comics with growing directly out of a piece in the old book called Cracking Jokes, because I was using comics to make not a story but an essay on the nature of humor, you know, using the panels as kind of cartoon diagrams to demo the theories that I was absorbing and reading. There's nothing more boring and unfunny than reading the theories of humor, but I got interested in, for 6 months, was reading everything I could and then distilled that into being a 4-page strip. But then there's also other things in other strips, because they're each short, discrete gestures and probes in one direction or another, where the word and picture are divided up and move you to, so you don't just see what you're being told in a very intense way. It happens in a one-page thing called Don't Get Around Much Anymore. And I know that that piece was important for several cartoonists who were kids at the time. That was happening, but then went, oh, geez, a light went on. So that I'm not saying that like Chris Ware would be anything other than a genius if he had ever bumped into me or not, but that work was important for him in trying to understand what a comic could be. You know, so it had an impact that way. But I think that Curtis is right to say that what it really did was it opened up like new possibilities. You know, for me,
right,
in terms of even making Mouse, and for other artists looking back on one kind of mad scientist experiment or another in those pages. And it insisted that the audience has to like slow down and meet the artist halfway. You know, I think that maybe is one of the biggest differences. You know, like for instance, I quote in the afterword that the introduction was made to explain the book, and then there's an afterword that I put after the old Breakdowns that explains the introduction. somewhere in that afterword, I quote Chris Ware, and he says, like, if somebody looks at a painting and doesn't understand it, they assume they're stupid, but if you read a comic and don't understand it, you assume the cartoonist is stupid.
Do you have any upcoming projects that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I have another project that's just out at the same minute as the new Breakdowns book, which is called Jack and the Box. It's the sixth book in a new series of small hardcover comics that my wife, Françoise Mouly, the art editor of The New Yorker and my co-creator of Raw Magazine when we did it, and she's publishing a series of comics that are doing something new in the world, which is putting our money where our mouths is and self-publishing comics that are not just to be read to a toddler or a tot, but comics that a very young kid could read for themselves as first books to read, because both me and Françoise, less so, but to a degree, learned to read from comics. And we watched our kids learn to read by destroying my comics collection, damn them. and we wanted to make comics that could actually like make that come forward more. So Françoise is working with cognitive scientists, teachers in schools, and librarians to really, as well as obviously with talented artists and writers, to make comic for 5-6-year-olds to enter into the world of books and learn to read.
Well, Art Spiegelman, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice. You're going to be coming to our area on Friday, October 24th at 7 p.m. at Hampshire College, Franklin Patterson Hall. We look forward to you coming to our area.
Thank you.
Comics artist Art Spiegelman. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Tune in next week for a conversation with David Danilow about his book, The Border, exploring the U.S.-Mexican divide. To find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming guests, visit our website at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.